following presentation was delivered at the Sheraton Nashua, Nashua, New Hampshire, during a dinner celebration held by the New Hampshire Center for Constitutional Studies to honor the 213th anniversary of the signing of the U.S. Constitution.
Folks, for such an evening like this, where we are going to articulate our understanding and our support for the fundamental principles of liberty that this nation was founded upon, it is fitting that we have with us tonight as our keynote speaker one who has had experience learning, understanding, and now defending the Constitution of the United States. Dr. Herb Titus was a respected and tenured professor of the University of Oregon and a lawyer for the ACLU and also a pronounced atheist. And then he stumbled into an Orthodox Presbyterian church, gave his heart to Jesus Christ, and his heart was transformed, and then his head got renewed. Now, folks, that is the picture of what must happen to this nation. A nation that has gone drunk with self-sufficiency and self-aggrandizement has become a lawyer for the destruction of liberty with atheism at its core. But there's hope because the old house can get a new heart and then a new head. And you see, when that happens and we get renewed, things begin to change. Dr. Titus has a long resume that you can read in your own brochure, but I'll tell you simply this, that not only now is he a defender of the Constitution of the United States and its separation of powers, he has begun a study committee in Congress to get congressmen and senators to actually vote constitutionally. Though it is quite a task, for only a few years ago, there was only one congressman to work with. Now there are 12. That's good. That's 12 times what there was before. We're making progress, but it's also a reality of where we're at. Not only does he work with Congress in dealing with constitutional issues, but he's become a defender of those who have been harassed as a result of our culture, like Michael New, who would not put on the UN insignia. He has been defended by Dr. Titus. Like Judge Roy Moore, who refused to take down the Ten Commandments, he's been defended by Dr. Titus. And also like the Boy Scouts of America, who refused to be bullied by the national government. And also like many individuals who got long, long, tedious census forms in the mail that were unconstitutional, they've been challenged by Dr. Titus and those individuals, not only dealing with the congressional branch, but the executive. The unconstitutional executive orders have been challenged by Dr. Titus in America's Briefs, and also dealing with suits that it is unconstitutional for a president to try to get away with being dictator in chief. And also dealing with the Supreme Court in writing laws by having state legislatures ignorant of the limited powers of the Supreme Court. Dr. Titus has come to the defense of those individuals in states who wish to stand up for state rights, knowing the law of the eternal law has never changed, regardless of the amendments to the Constitution. Thus, it gives me great pleasure here tonight to say to you that if, like Sam Adams, we have perused this temple of royalty that government espouses for itself and find that it has eyes that do not see, ears that do not hear, and a heart that has grown cold, we need to join together. And it is really good, folks, tonight that Dr. Titus is on our side and not the other. Let's welcome him tonight as he comes and addresses us.
And the opinions of the Supreme Court about the Constitution. And tonight, as we sketch out a blueprint for state action to recover constitutional liberty and law to America, we're actually going to look at the document and read what it says. For those of you who may not have a constitution, just put up your hand. There will be some young people who are walking through the audience here to get into your hands a copy of the Constitution. You see, I taught constitutional law for 30 years. And for those years when I did not believe in God, when I walked in my atheism, I didn't bother to read the Constitution either. After I became a Christian, I decided to read the document. Much the same as an atheist, I never bothered to read the Bible. And after I became a Christian, I read what was written. We've been talking today at this wonderful celebration of the 213th anniversary of the Constitution of the United States about states' rights. And properly, the focus of the evening has been on the 10th Amendment. But the 10th Amendment is only the beginning of a constitutional inquiry, a constitutional blueprint for state action to restore constitutional liberty and law to America. Let me read the words again to you, even though they've been read once already. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, this is on page 23 of the Constitution that has been furnished to you, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, are to the people. Now, I've talked to many people about the 10th Amendment, and what's always interesting to me is that people read the 10th Amendment and then don't ask the next question. What are those powers? What are those powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by that Constitution to the states, that are reserved to the states respectively and to the people? We don't have time tonight to go through the list of those powers, but I want to talk to you this evening about one power that has been forgotten. In all of the literature that I have read, the power of interposition has been forgotten in America. And yet at the very heart of liberty and law in America has been the exercise of the power of lower civil magistrates to interpose between the people and a tyrannical government. Indeed, if you read the Declaration of Independence, you will see that it was the lower civil magistrates of the colonial assemblies that risked their lives, their fortunes, and their honors to intercede, to interpose between the people and a tyrannical king and a lawless parliament. And what's interesting about that interposition in the Declaration of Independence, it was state by state by state. And indeed, if you look at the last paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, and I commend the Center for including the Declaration of Independence along with the Constitution. After all, the Declaration is the charter of the nation, and the Constitution is its bylaws. You cannot read the one apart from the other. And if you look at the last paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, which is on page 39, you will see that they were the representatives of the United States of America, and they declared the independence of the states, free and independent states. There was never a time in the history of this great nation that we were one national government. There was no such thing as a one nation. It was a nation of free and independent states, because it was the officers of the state that interceded, that interposed themselves between the people and the tyrannical king and the lawless parliament. And so it is today that the states are established by the United States Constitution to interpose between the people and a tyrannical government that has taken over the nation in Washington, D.C. And I want to talk to you this evening about four practical action opportunities for the states of the United States of America to interpose between the people whose liberties and whose lawful opportunities are being stolen from them by a tyrannical government that has taken over in Washington, D.C. I want first to talk about political interposition. And then second, I want to talk about legal interposition. And then third, economic interposition. And finally, lastly, constitutional interposition. If you look at the subscription clause of the Constitution of the United States, and again, I commend the center for putting the subscription clause in this document, because many times you will find constitutions that do not have that clause. Isn't it interesting that when George Washington and his compatriots signed this document, it said this, done in convention by the unanimous consent of the states. Every individual who was at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia was there as a representative of the people of the several states. George Washington did not think that he was there representing all the people of the United States. No, he was there to represent the people of the state of Virginia. And likewise, everyone who put their signature to the Constitution was there as a lower civil magistrate representing the states, interposing themselves between the people and this new government that would be established. Indeed, if you look at the next page, which is page 18, you will see that they resolved that this Constitution would be submitted for ratification state by state by state. It would not be submitted to the people as a whole, because the people of the United States don't act as a whole. They act state by state by state. It was to retain the principle that this was a union of free and independent sovereign states, and that the officials of each state had a duty to protect the liberties of the people of the states that they represented. And one way that they would protect the liberties of the people would be that this new constitution would not be a constitution of the United States unless it was ratified by at least 9 state conventions composed of representatives elected by the peoples of each of those 13 original states, retaining, therefore, the power of the states to interpose between the people of the state and this new government, should this government not obey the new written constitution. Now let's get into the 4 practical things that I believe state officials today should be doing on behalf of the people of each state of this union. First of all, presidential elections. If you look at the Constitution, you will see that there is only one authority who determines how presidents are to be elected. The manner of electing the President of the United States is in the hands of each state legislature. Congress has no power to determine the manner by which the President of the United States is elected. Turn with me, if you want to, on page 9 of the Constitution, and you will see in Article 2, Section 1, Paragraph 2, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislators thereof may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress, but no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector. Do you know that the state legislature of New Hampshire could decide that the presidential electors of this state would be appointed by the state legislature? There's nothing in the Constitution that commands that the president be popularly elected. Do you know that Congress today completely governs the manner by which the president is elected in America today through a federal election commission that subsidizes the president with your money? I know many of you, perhaps all of you, have never checked that box that says the money that I'm sending in, $3 can go to the president. Do you know they don't pay attention to that box? They still take your money. That box is only there to give the Congress guidance as to how much money of your money will be appropriated to subsidize the presidential election. Perhaps some of you read just recently in the Wall Street Journal where one of the new members of the Federal Election Commission said, "Did you enjoy the Democratic and Republican national conventions? You should have. You paid for them." Not only that, but they give special licensing privileges to some candidates and not others. What will we see in the October debates but Tweedledum and Tweedledee? Because the FEC is composed of three Democrats and three Republicans. And it's deliberately designed that way by Congress to shape the political debate so that it's either going to be a Republican or a Democrat, and it's increasingly hard to tell the difference. Yes, it is. It's a licensed duopoly. Isn't it interesting that the government is chasing Microsoft when they ought to be chasing the Democrat and Republican parties that have monopolized the elections through law? And yet Article 2, Section 1, the second paragraph, says it's the state legislatures that have the authority to determine the manner by which presidents are elected. Congress has no authority to limit campaign contributions to a presidential candidate. Congress has no authority to prohibit soft money, hard money, or whatever kind of money, stolen money, or, well, that thing they call paper money. They have no authority. And it's time for the state legislatures to step in and say, we will do our constitutional duty. We will determine the manner by which the president is elected according to Article 2, Section 1, the second paragraph. That, ladies and gentlemen, is political interposition, and it's time for the state legislatures to take their constitutional duty seriously and determine the manner by which the president is elected. Now, if you don't believe this, let me take you over to page 10, and you'll see what Congress's role is in the election of the president. It says Congress may determine the time of the choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes, which day shall be the same throughout the United States. That's all Congress has authority to do, is to determine the time. And the place where the electors meet to elect the president is determined by the 12th Amendment. Contrast that language with Article 1, Section 4, which states, and this is on page 3, the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. Ah, the state legislatures even have the authority to determine the time, place, and manner of the election of members of the House and the Senate. But there's an escape clause. But the Congress may, at any time by law, make or alter such regulation. Notice, Congress does have authority with regard to the time, place, and manner with respect to members of the House and the Senate, but by the constitutional text itself, they have only the authority to determine the day on which the electors of the Electoral College meet. And notice, if you would, turn back to Article 2, Section 1, not one member of the House and not one member of the Senate can be one of those electors. They are disqualified. Why? If you read the Federalist Papers, you would know, because they did not want the president to be dependent upon Congress. They wanted the president to be responsive to the state legislatures and the states. It was designed deliberately to enhance the power of the states vis-a-vis the one who was elected to the highest office of the land, that the president would not be a tyrant, but would be responsive to the interests of the people, state by state by state. Legal interposition. The United States Supreme Court recently struck down the partial birth abortion statute enacted by the Nebraska state legislature. And in the process, struck down all the other partial birth abortion statutes passed by over 35 state legislatures. In addition, the United States Supreme Court ruled in a case out of Texas that people could no longer pray at football games in Texas. Now, if any of you are from Texas, you'll know that that's fighting words, that you can't pray at a football game. If George W. Bush was a constitutional governor, he would have told the United States Supreme Court, "We will not obey that lawless order." If the governor of Nebraska was doing his constitutional duty, he would have told the United States Supreme Court, "We will enforce the law prohibiting partial birth abortion in this state. I don't care what the Supreme Court has said." But neither the governor of Nebraska nor the governor of Texas has read Article 6 of the Constitution. You see, today, state officials would have you believe that the only one who has a constitutional duty is the court. Indeed, they think the Supreme Court is supreme. Now, I have read Article 6 recently, and it doesn't say this Supreme Court is the supreme law of the land. To the contrary, it says this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. A court opinion is not the Constitution. A court opinion is just a court opinion. Sir William Blackstone put it this way: a court opinion is only evidence of law. And of course, today, most court opinions are bad evidence of law because they don't pay attention to the law. They don't read the Constitution. They just read their own opinions. But turn and look at the second paragraph of Article 6 of the United States Constitution on page 16. Notice what it says: the senators and representatives before mentioned, and the members of the several state legislatures, and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution, not the opinions of the Supreme Court about what the Constitution means. You see, every state officer, whether they be governor or state legislator or attorney general or local prosecutor or police officer or sheriff, is bound by Article 6 to support this Constitution. If the United States Supreme Court renders an opinion contrary to the Constitution, what are state officials, by their oath of office, bound to do? Disobey. Disobey. Guess what that would do? That would require then the president to send out the National Guard. Now, can't you see the president sending a National Guard out to a Texas football game? You see, the power of the state to interpose on behalf of the people in the name of this Constitution is a power that has been neglected, not because it's not in the 10th Amendment in the Constitution, because they would rather you not know that they have that duty. Life is much easier to say the Supreme Court has spoken. We must obey. But you see, Article 2, Section 3 of the United States Constitution says that the president, let's look at that. We'll find it over on page 12 of the Constitution, and you will see it says in the last phrase of Section 3, it says, the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Notice, if a state governor would refuse to obey a United States Supreme Court opinion, it would require the president to decide what the law is. He would have to determine whether or not the court opinion is law. And if he sent out the National Guard, we would know that it was only by force, not by law, that that decree was enforced. We have not seen a constitutional governor for some time in this nation. It was too bad that Fob James and the great state of Alabama forgot its history when they didn't re-elect Fob James, because remember what Fob James said? He said, if a federal court tells Judge Roy Moore to take the Ten Commandments off the wall of his courtroom, I will be at the door of the courthouse. That's the kind of governor that this Constitution contemplates. That's the kind of governor that we must insist upon. That's the kind of governor that would interpose and do his constitutional duty on behalf of the people of his state against a tyrannical Supreme Court. After all, one thing about courts is they can't enforce their own opinions. That's the reason why Alexander Hamilton called them the least dangerous branch, because the only one who can enforce a court opinion is the one who has executive power. And if a governor, which has executive power in a state, says, I will not execute that Supreme Court opinion, then it's going to require the president to send out the troops. Economic interposition. We've heard much talk tonight about the 16th Amendment. And there's no question that the 16th Amendment has been used to rob the people of what is rightfully theirs. And oftentimes, state officials hide behind the 16th Amendment and say, well, it's because the federal government takes all the taxes and sends them to Washington, and we just don't have any power anymore because we can't raise enough money from the people. Instead of asking themselves, what kind of economic power do they have? I'm working on a case. As a matter of fact, we filed an amicus brief in this case recently, challenge the constitutionality of the Clean Air Act on the grounds that it was an unlawful delegation of congressional power, because if you look at the statute where you ask yourself what the rules are with regard to clean air, you can't discover them in the statute, even though Article 1, Section 1 of the United States Constitution vests all legislative power in Congress, and the very essence of legislative power is to pass the rules. Instead, the EPA passes the rules. But did you know they don't enforce them? Did you know that the EPA, when it passed those recent rules about ozone and particulate matter in the air, that they don't enforce them? Do you know who does? The states. The states enforce the federal standards of clean air, which weren't even enacted by Congress. Now, by what constitutional authority do the states have to enforce a federal law? Answer, none. Zero. Zip. How do we know that? Well, because we, unlike most governors, are reading the Constitution, and we have discovered Article 2, Section 2. Turn with me, if you would, to Article 2, Section 2. And you will find on page 11 in the second paragraph these words: the president shall have power by and with the advice and consent of the Senate to make treaties provided 2/3 of the senators present concur, and he shall nominate and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for. May I ask you this question? Did the president appoint the governor of New Hampshire?
No.
No. The people of the state of New Hampshire elected the governor of New Hampshire. So is the governor of New Hampshire a federal officer? No. And yet the Clean Air Act requires him to enforce the clean air standards passed by the EPA. Now, why would Congress do that? Because it's regulation on the cheap. It's cheaper that way. They're called unfunded mandates. They mandate the state officials to enforce the federal law because they don't want to take the money that they have and spend that money to enforce the rules. Do you know why else Congress doesn't want to enforce the rules? Because they don't want to make the hard choices. Because when the EPA lays down a new rule about ozone or particulate matter, it's up to the governor to decide what industries have to be shut down. He has to make the tough choices. You see, unless the state officials do their constitutional duty and refuse to lend the economic power that they still have despite the 16th Amendment, because Congress doesn't want to spend that money, not just to enforce many environmental laws, but education laws. We heard an eloquent plea here tonight from Azola Foster that the United States government has no authority in education. What would happen if the school board simply said, "We will not take your money"? I don't know if you are like I, but I've read recent studies where schools and their quality of education doesn't really turn on how much money they spend. As a matter of fact, I've seen that the more money they spend, the worse the education they have. We need to get away from the notion that if you spend more money, you'll get more quality. Matter of fact, you know where all that money goes? To people who don't teach. Isn't it interesting that now what we've discovered is that teachers teach because they can't do, and administrators don't teach because they can't teach. And that's where the money goes, to those who can't teach. So Congress has essentially enslaved the states just as much as the court has usurped state power, and the FEC has hijacked the presidential election process. It is time not only for political interposition, not only for legal interposition, not only economic interposition, but it is time for constitutional interposition. Do you know the greatest danger to our liberty is not in Washington, D.C. It's in New York City. In New York City. If you have been following the newspapers recently, they had a conference on global government. And it was the United Nations. I have a copy of the Charter of the United Nations. I don't know how many of you have read it. I recommend you read it. I would not recommend you read it just before you go to bed. We are told that the United Nations Charter is a treaty. It is not. It was never designed as a treaty. It was designed as a constitution for a world government from the beginning. Do you know that the United Nations Charter, like the United States Constitution, has a provision by which it may be amended without it ever being submitted to the Senate of the United States for ratification? It has its own internal amendment process. Just as the United States Constitution may be amended without the unanimous consent of the states, the United Nations Charter can be amended without the unanimous consent of the member nations. Did you know that new members may be added to the United Nations without all members agreeing? Libya could be added tomorrow. Some people say, yes, but we have veto power in the Security Council. But veto power in the Security Council is not according to the constitutional provision, even with regard to a treaty. If a new member is added to the United Nations, it should be only if it's ratified by the Constitution or by the Senate, if it were a treaty. But it was never designed to be a treaty. Indeed, all you have to do is look at the first words of the Charter of the United Nations, and you will see that it's not a treaty. This is what it says. We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined. We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined. Look at the United States Constitution. And if you look on page 1, what does it say? We, the people of the United States. If the United Nations Charter was a treaty, it would say we, the government officials of the various member nations, because they are the ones who have authority to enter a treaty. Why did they say we, the peoples
of the United Nations, because they were displacing the Constitution of the United States with a new constitutional document. But unlike the Constitution of the United States, it has never been submitted for ratification by the people of the United States. It is an illegitimate document. It is an illegitimate organization and must be resisted. I read President Clinton's speech that he made during that Council on Global Governance, and he was giving kudos to Kofi Annan, that wonderful United Nations bureaucrat. Incidentally, he's the first one who came up through the ranks to become Secretary General. And this is what he said about Kofi Annan. This man was sent from heaven. There's only one that I know is sent from heaven. There is only one who is Prince of Peace. The United Nations would bring peace by outlawing war. They outlaw war by ridding us of our national boundaries, because then everything becomes a police action. Is that what they are about? Yes. In a Human Development Report 2000 that was issued just about a month and a half ago, Kofi Annan was quoted this way. He says, "The United Nations is composed of member nations, but it exists for the benefit of the peoples of the world, and no national boundaries will stand in the way of our reaching the peoples of the world." That's Kofi Annan. That's the United Nations, and that's the way it was designed. You know, some people say, well, they haven't yet taxed us. Yes, they have. Yes, they have. Article 1, Section 7 of the Constitution says this: "All bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives." All bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives. Do you know where the bill originates that raises revenue for the United Nations? The General Assembly. That's why they bill us. It would be the same as if the EPA said, "This is the amount of money we need. Now, you owe it to us, Congress." You see, we are already being taxed without representation. It already violates that principle upon which the American Revolution was fought: no taxation without representation. We must resist the illegitimate and unlawful United Nations that would usurp the power of the people to constitute the government as this nation has been founded. How do we do that? May I propose that cities, counties, states pass laws declaring that they are United Nations free zones? There is a way of combating an illegitimate intrusion upon the national sovereignty of the nation and the sovereignty of the 50 states. And it's time that the people rise up and remind our government officials that we constitute the government, they don't. And we reconstitute the government, they don't. It's time for action in this arena, lest we continue to be betrayed by the President of the United States and his minions in the Senate who are afraid to stand on principle. In the House of Representatives, there is a bill, 1146. It is sponsored by 16 members of the House. The leading sponsor is Congressman Ron Paul from Texas. Praise God for Texas. I mean, the Republic of Texas doesn't think the federal government belongs in Texas, much less the United Nations. There are 17 sponsors of this bill. 2 years ago, Ron Paul, by an amendment to an appropriations bill, got 54 votes from members of the House to get the United States out of the United Nations and the United Nations out of the United States. I had the privilege of writing the constitutional analysis, some of which I've shared with you this evening, in support of H.R. 1146. If you want to see that analysis, you can find it on the Internet. And if you've got a pencil and paper, it's www.libertystudy.com. I'm sorry, .org. That's www.libertystudy, libertystudy.org. And if you're someone who prays, and even if you don't, you ought, may I ask you to pray a prayer based upon Proverbs 21:1, the heart of a king is a channel of water in God's hands. He moves it whichever way that he wishes. Indeed, if we are to see action as I have outlined it to you tonight, if we are to see the state officials interpose and once again bring the presidential election back home where it belongs, out of the clutches of the FEC, if we're to see state officials to exercise the legal authority they have to defend the Constitution against unconstitutional opinions of the United States Supreme Court, if we're going to see state officials who are willing to exercise the economic power that they have, even though they might risk losing some of those federal funds, and if we're to see the people of the United States rise up and say, we are the ones who constitute our government, we will not be a part of an unconstitutional United Nations, we need to pray. Because what I've outlined to you tonight is impossible. Now, I have a lot of friends in Ohio, and I know the Ohio motto, with God, all things are possible. Because he's the one who moves the hearts of kings. I was once involved with a Christian law school in which we had to go before the American Bar Association to be accredited. And I can assure you that the American Bar Association was not happy that the Bible had re-entered a law school classroom. And this law school that I was associated with was, of all places, Oral Roberts University. We got one vote from a committee in June and 22 against us. And this was in 1981. We had the opportunity to get a second review and we got one vote and there were 21 against us. And that was in June. Did I say May? May and June. In August, the ABA accredited the law school at Oral Roberts University. Why? Because God moves the hearts, even of accrediting authorities, of the American Bar Association. Do you know why I know that? Because we took them to court. And guess what? God gave us an activist liberal judge. Praise God for activist liberal judges. Who told the ABA, if you don't accredit that law school, I will. Now, the ABA could have appealed and taken it to a higher court. Instead, they folded. And that second committee, where we only got one vote, voted unanimously for us, and the chairman of that committee spoke on our behalf and voted for us. 2 weeks later, I received a letter in the mail, and enclosed was a newspaper article in which that man who voted for us, who spoke on our behalf, said this: the biggest mistake that the ABA has ever done is a credit to law school at ORU. The heart of a king is as a channel of water in God's hands. He moves it whichever way he wishes. So if we are to see a blueprint of restoration where the states take their constitutional duty and right of interposition, we better be on our knees praying that even those state governors that wouldn't want to do it would be moved by God to do what they don't want to do. You see, God is not out of the nation-building business. He still moves kings and governors and presidents and judges. We just need to take a stand. And in order for us to take that stand, we need to know what the Constitution says. Jesus Christ, who is my political hero, demonstrated that when he encountered the devil in the wilderness. Remember what happened when he was challenged by the devil to turn the stone into bread? He had the power to do it. There was no question he's the Son of God. But he didn't have the authority to do it, because he said this: man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Satan picked up on that in the next temptation when he said, jump off the top of the pinnacle of this temple. And then he quoted scripture, because the angels will take care of you. But remember what Jesus said? He says, you live by every word of God. And he responded to the devil, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. And then Satan showed him all the kingdoms and principalities of the world and said, they're yours for the taking if you will bow down and worship me. And Jesus said, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God and him only. And remember, each time that Jesus responded, he said, it is written, it is written, it is written. If we are to serve in this nation, then we not only need to know the written word of God, we need to know the written word of the Constitution. And if we neglect that written word, how can we hold our state officials to what is written? Even Chief Justice Marshall, if you read the case of Marbury and Madison, said that the reason why the court would strike down a congressional statute and had the power to do so was because the Constitution is written. It is written, he said. It's written for the purpose of establishing the rule of law by which no government official can transcend. And then he said this. He said, the Constitution is an instrument for the government of the court as well as an instrument for the government of Congress. He did not believe that the court was above the written Constitution, because he had read Article 6, where it says, this Constitution is the supreme law of the land. Not a court opinion. Not your opinion, not my opinion, but the Constitution as it is written. I challenge you. I exhort you. I encourage you. As God calls you, as citizens of this great land, that you step out in faith, trusting that as you stand for the written covenant of this great nation, and as you call upon your local officials, your state officials, to interpose and defend the liberties of the people against the tyranny that we face in this nation, that you will do your part, and when you meet your Maker, he will look and say, well done, my good and faithful servant. God bless you. Thank you so much for inviting me to be with you. The question is where can you get a charter of the United Nations? Well, that's a good question. I don't know how I got this charter, but it has the imprint of the United Nations itself. I'm pretty confident that if you wrote the United Nations, you could probably get some charters. They're very proud of them. Maybe someone has the answer to that question. Yes, sir. Okay, but I think that you should be able to get a copy of the charter, and you really need to read it.
Question I have is, you've spoken several times of the 16th Amendment. To my understanding, and several of us in this room, that the 16th Amendment never was really legally ratified. Can you straighten me out on that, please?
Well, I'm not sure I can straighten you out on that. Let me just say to you that I think that there are other ways that are more effective than fighting that particular battle. I do not believe that you will ever get a court ruling on whether or not it was legally ratified or not, because the courts have consistently ruled that that's a political decision made by Congress. It's not a legal question. And therefore, the courts are not going to address whether or not that was lawfully ratified. Now, I'm not telling you that a court won't do that, because they might do that. It's just that courts have consistently refused to rule on that particular question. I think that the real issue, in my view, is what is constitutional income? I believe that we assume that wages is constitutional income. I do not believe that is correct. And, of course, that's where most of the tax is levied today, is on wages. And so I think that there are other arguments that I would focus on and concentrate on as a practical matter, as a priority matter, rather than to wrestle with that, I think, very difficult question, both in terms of the historical evidence as well as in terms of trying to bring that kind of an issue before a court. Yes, sir.
Mr. Titus.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I
have a roaming microphone?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. We'll get you next. I'm sorry. You're the one getting the mic out.
Sorry. Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Titus, Bob Bevel, Merrimack, New Hampshire. My question is something you already touched on a little bit, but I'd like for you to elucidate a little more. And that is, for example, in the state of Texas last week, they are being held captive by the federal government for their federal highway funds until they enact a stronger DWI law.
Yeah.
Would you comment on that, sir?
Yeah, on a case recently, well, not recently, about 15 years ago, South Dakota tried to resist the feds imposing a similar rule in South Dakota with regard to that, and they lost that particular case before the United States Supreme Court. My own view would be that if I were in Texas, I would continue to resist that, and I would relitigate that issue, because I think that there may very well be five justices on the United States Supreme Court that would come out in a different way. Primarily on the strength of two recent cases, the Lopez case, where the United States Supreme Court struck down the gun-free school zone law of Congress, and the gender-motivated rape case, which they also struck down. So I do think that there are opportunities to litigate those kinds of issues today that have not been done before. My other suggestion is it's time for states to just simply say, we won't take your money. I really think it's time to do that.
Yes, Dr. Titus, could you bring us up to date on what is happening with Michael New and his case?
Yeah, the Michael New case has been working its way up slowly in the military courts. The appeal is currently before the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. It was argued back in February by Hank Hamilton, who's been handling the military side of the Michael New legal defense. I'm handling the civilian side. And we attempted, as you know, to prevent the court-martial from happening altogether by filing a habeas corpus, which we were unsuccessful. The major issue before the United States Court of Appeals, or I'm sorry, the United States Court, Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, the major issue is this. When Michael New was charged, he was charged with violating a lawful order. Michael New's defense was that the order was unlawful. The court-martial did not allow him to present that defense to the six military men who tried the case. In other words, the very thing that's the gist of the offense, they took away from him. And at the oral arguments, you could see that at least three of the five judges believed that that was not right, that it was inconsistent with not only some Supreme Court cases, but clearly inconsistent with the notion of a criminal provision. And that's the basis we think that if the court decides in Michael New's favor, it will be on that ground. But don't be surprised if the court comes out differently. If Michael New loses that, then our next step is to file a cert petition with the United States Supreme Court, which we certainly intend to do. And if they don't take the case, then we'll go back to the federal district court on habeas corpus. So there's a continued need for Michael New for his defense. I know that sometimes it takes a long time and people wonder what's happening, but there's a continued need to assist Michael New's legal defense fund.
Dr. Titus, Ken Blevins, I just have a question about a case, a federal case that I heard about regarding the IRS and taxes. And there was a gentleman from England who had his profits from his property being sold in either Washington or Oregon State. And his defense was that seeing the federal income tax was a voluntary tax, therefore the penalty had to be voluntary. And if it was voluntary, he didn't have to pay it. Could you explain where that is and what's happening with it?
I don't know about that particular case, so I can't comment on that particular case. I don't follow those cases real closely. I do know of one or two people who have succeeded in persuading juries not to convict, but I do not know of anyone who has secured a legal ruling from a judge to that effect. Not that it couldn't possibly be, it's just that I haven't heard of any ruling along that particular line.
For those of you who live in New Hampshire and wish to establish a nuclear or UN-free zone or anything else, reasonable or unreasonable, you can work through New Hampshire statute. I'll quote you the language. RSA 39:3, to see if the town will, semicolon, and insert any language you desire to be placed on your town meeting warrant next March. Separately, and as part of your presentation, welfare for political parties and political candidates. The candidate of the Libertarian Party, Harry Brown, has refused $1,200,000 of welfare offered. Pat Buchanan will accept 100% of it. $12 million. Thank you.
Let me just make a comment about that. You know, one of the most neglected provisions in the United States Constitution is found in Article 1, Section 9, and then again in Article 1, Section 10, and that is the prohibition against titles of nobility. Both states and the United States are prohibited to grant a title of nobility. Alexander Hamilton said that that was the cornerstone of a republican form of government. Now, you have to ask yourself the question, why is it that the cornerstone of a republican form of government has never been litigated in any case? Why is it that we've forgotten what the prohibition against titles of nobility are? And the reason is because it's the most violated provision of the United States Constitution that I know of. The prohibition against titles of nobility was not to prohibit Congress from granting someone the name of Lord or Baron or something like that. It was to prohibit the entitlement that came with it. People did not want to be called Sir or Baron for the name. They wanted to be called Sir or Baron because along with it came economic and political privilege. The FEC gives a title of nobility to the Democrats and the Republicans to the exclusion of other political parties, because it gives economic and political privileges that deny somebody else. Welfare, by definition, is a title of nobility, because it gives a certain amount of money to people who qualify, even though they might be poor. You can have poor barons and poor baronesses as well as rich ones. And until we get away from government by entitlement, we will never see a republican form of government in America as we used to have. It is the cornerstone of a republican form of government to prohibit all political and economic entitlements. That alone is worth an evening. God bless you.
Thank you, Dr. Titus.